Welcome back to the Clear Admit MBA Admissions Podcast. I'm your host, Graham Richmond, and today we're going to be talking about Stanford Graduate School of Business's annual Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Report. And I'm joined by two very special guests from the school, and they are Lori Nishiura McKenzie, who is the co-founder of Stanford VMware Women's Leadership Innovation Lab. And that's an innovation lab on campus that works with over 60 companies, helping them to be more inclusive. Lori is also the lead strategist of the diversity, equity, and inclusion activities on campus. And I'm also joined by Sarah Sewell, who is the Senior Associate Dean in charge of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at Stanford, and she's also the Morgridge Professor of Organizational Behavior at the Graduate School of Business. So welcome both Lori and Sarah. Appreciate you making time to talk today.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Graham.
So the first question I had is I just wanted to better understand the background about the DEI report. So, Sarah, do you think you could tell me a little bit about the origins of the report? I mean, what brought it about, and how long was this kind of in the works before the first report was published?
Sure, Graham. Happy to say a little bit about that. So in 2016, Dean John Levin joined the Graduate School of Business, and diversity, equity, and inclusion from the start was one of his passions. And something about what he talked about very, very early on was a vision for increasing the diversity of our faculty, our students and staff, and also promoting a sense of inclusion and belonging at the school. So after about a year in office, he asked me to be in charge of these efforts. And so essentially, I spent the first year to 18 months gathering a lot of data from our key stakeholders, our students, our staff, our faculty, alumni, peers, also colleagues from other schools at Stanford, both individual connections that I had, but also through the Provost and President's initiative on diversity, equity, and inclusion. In January of 2019, we brought Lori on, first as a consultant, to help me to synthesize all the data, all of the information that I had gathered over these first about 18 months, actually. And we began to craft the first draft of the report. Then over the summer, we really spent most of our time gathering feedback from all of these same stakeholders, spending a lot of time iterating and evolving the report until this fall when we launched it. Also, importantly, in the fall, that's when Lori joined us in her current role as the lead strategist. So it was a long time coming. It took a lot of effort from not just myself, but again, the staff here, the students here, alumni, and it was a long, but I think really, I think incredibly fulfilling project for us here.
Yeah, and I read the report with great interest when it came out, and I wanted to ask you, since I just thought it'd be useful for our listeners, if you could kind of walk through some of the key findings that came out of this first report, and then I want to actually turn to Lori in a moment and ask some more specific questions about how it's organized, but what were some of the key findings for you, Sarah?
The key finding in this report is that the GSB was already doing an astonishing amount of work around diversity, equity, and inclusion. But much of this existed in the various units and departments, and there wasn't much sharing across these units and departments. And so what we wanted to do, I think, was first bring this all together and begin to get more collaboration across our various units and departments. Our overall motto at the GSB is to change lives, change organizations, and change the world. And Lori and I really believe that first we needed to do this within by beginning to share across units, but then begin to share externally to our peers and also to other organizations interested in diversity, equity, and inclusion. So that was probably the first key finding. But we also found a number of other interesting things in terms of the data that we collected for this. One of the things that I think was pretty interesting was that many of our classes, which I'm sure is the same trend at our peers, bring in expert guest speakers from industry and from other organizations. And they bring them in either as case protagonists or subject matter experts. And one of the things that we did was collected data over the last 5 or 6 years on who was presenting in our classroom. And one of the things that I think was pretty interesting for us is that we've seen an upward trajectory in terms at least of the gender breakdown of the guests who come to our class, such that about a third of them now are guest speakers are women. Now, there's obviously more that we can be doing, but importantly, the trajectory is in the right direction.
And I think another interesting piece of data is with regard to the gender composition of our junior faculty. Right now, if we look at our full tenure line faculty, about 20% of them are women. But if we look at the junior faculty only, it's about a third of our junior faculty, which are women. Again, this isn't at parity, but it's much, much better than it used to be. And more importantly, this is a result of a deliberate attempt at our hiring. So basically, over the last 4, 5, 6 years or so, 40% of our junior hires have been women. And I think this also indicates that this is going in exactly the right direction.
And that sort of mirrors what we've been seeing around the kind of graduate education or MBA domain, where more and more schools are, in terms of the student body at least, are able to get, you know, up to kind of 40% and even north of 40% women. So that's nice to hear that that's happening on the faculty side as well, because that's always an area that, you know, I always look at and that, you know, was kind of featured in the report. Lori, I wanted to kind of turn over to you and ask, you know, there are these four kind of key sections to the report. And, you know, the first one is identify challenges and frame solutions. The second is build strategic pilots. The third is share with networks and bring good ideas into the world. And the last one is advance our work. And so I was wondering if you could just sort of walk me through what happens in each of these sections. Like, what's the goal? What are you trying to cover in each section of the report?
Absolutely. And these four sections are in response to a question. How do you move from a constellation of all these bright lights throughout the school and to build momentum around more like a movement? So the first section is about identifying challenges. Sarah and I believe that you first have to understand where you are before you can identify where you need to go. So we started with the university's ideal dashboard. That's a new website feature that reports on the makeup of every school at Stanford. It helped us understand the GSB as a unit, but also how we nest inside the larger university. And we also gathered data from other areas within the school so we could paint a full picture of where we are to identify where we need to go to change. And this enabled us to hone in two of our five key priorities, which is to increase the diversity of our community and to create a more inclusive campus so we can attract, welcome, and retain a diverse and global GSB community. So that's part one. And then in terms of building strategic pilots, you know, we realize you can't boil the ocean. So our approach is to create and foster strategic pilots to advance and initiate our work in priority areas. And what we mean by that is, what if we tested really good ideas with our stakeholders and then figured out what works and shared them? And I can share one example that I love. Our alumni office created what they call women's circles, which is these circles of women who meet to collaborate and also learn from one another. And this year, our students launched their own version, which they call Pods, which brings together diverse students and allows them to learn together and be mentored by second-year students. And our staff is also looking at a model like that, where groups of staff would come together to learn about diversity and inclusion. So moving this idea of piloting an idea in one area and having it spread throughout the organization. The third section is called share, you know, with these good ideas with our networks. And we want to leverage these ideas with our alums in order to bring the ideas out into the world. And I can share an example of that. We have this new program called an Immersion Scholar Program. And what that means is we've designed a program to bring in an advanced doctoral student to campus so they could bring fresh research perspectives to the GSB while also introducing our faculty and students to a remarkable young scholar. And our first inaugural scholar was Lumumba Seegers, who studies employee resource groups, which, as you might know, is a really important part of diversity and inclusion efforts. So we organized a dinner with our alums to introduce Lumumba's research and him to them, but also to expose him to the kinds of organizations where he might do research if he eventually came to the GSB. And of course, the last section is advance our work, because we know that this is just the beginning and we want to learn from this work this year and continue the momentum built year over year.
Yeah, that makes sense. I did find, you know, just looking at the report, I thought it was really elegantly kind of framed and put together in this way. And I think you're going to probably correct me if I'm wrong here, but I feel like there was an interesting piece about looking at cases that are used in the classroom and, you know, the number of protagonists who are female or underrepresented minorities and just ensuring that there's a better balance there. Am I remembering that correctly? I feel like that was a piece of this.
Absolutely. We care deeply about the materials that our students read in the classroom, and we wanted to make sure that none of the cases have stereotypical trends that might make them feel like they're not framed in the best light. So we analyzed all the language of the case studies they would see in the first year. In some cases, we're helping our case team to rewrite them. And in others, we're letting faculty know about these trends so that they can be informed in advance of going into the classroom and having the students discover it on their own. So we hope this will go full circle. We've also collaborated with our friends at Harvard Business School on this project, and hopefully from both sides of the country, we'll create some change.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, obviously, there would be no sense in bringing together a really diverse class to have them read cases that all feature like white guys.
Absolutely.
Right? So it's good to work on both sides of this. So what do you think, Lori, are the key focal points regarding the DEI for Stanford in the kind of 2019-2020 admissions season or academic year? Like, are there things that are going to be, are there changes coming or ways that you're looking at admissions or even the academic, you know, the curriculum, et cetera, for this coming year that are coming out of that report?
Absolutely. There are five key priorities we have, and you know, our new students will be part of it, and as our current students are as well. The first one is to increase the diversity of our Stanford community, and we include in that our faculty, students, and staff. The second key priority is to create an inclusive classroom and learning experience. I think you touched on one of our key priorities there, the materials in the classroom. But it'll also include, you know, giving our faculty some new tools to talk about these sensitive topics and thinking about including diversity, equity, inclusion in the curriculum that students can learn from. We want to, as our third priority, create an inclusive and welcoming campus community. And this is one where our students can truly collaborate with us, making sure that we engage students, staff, and alums in making all of the experiences on campus feel as welcoming and inclusive as possible. The fourth key priority is empowering and supporting communities underrepresented in our efforts to date. We realize we've done good work. There's a lot of room left to go, and we want to make sure we focus especially on communities that were not as featured in our earlier efforts. And our last one, I think, is really exciting as well. It's supporting new research efforts. There's so much we don't know, and we want to encourage our researchers to ask the meaningful questions that will shed lights on the barriers to inclusion in order for us to inspire new solutions that hopefully we'll be able to test right here at GSB.
That makes a lot of sense. So, Sarah, if I can turn back to you, given your role in kind of the, you know, curriculum, and obviously you're a professor, do you, like, are faculty reading this report actively? Have you seen any kind of grassroots things happening? How is this sort of shaping the MBA curriculum specifically?
Oh, yeah, sure, Graham. We're getting a lot of very interesting indications that this is going to dramatically shape what's going on in the curriculum. So as you know from the report, we already have a number of courses that have to do with diversity, equity, and inclusion in various ways, whether it's a class on entrepreneurship from diverse perspectives, to classes for about really increasing diversity within organizations, one of them called Equity by Design, and so on. So we already have a number of very interesting offerings. But one of the things that we've seen is that once the report was published, a number of faculty members reached out and said, hey, my class should be featured here. It may not be obvious from the title, but for example, my class on people analytics, one of the core goals of that class is figuring out how to use analytics within companies to increase diversity and so on. So I think what we're seeing is that our faculty are reaching out to us and highlighting parts of their courses that already have material and modules around diversity, equity, and inclusion. But beyond that, I think there are a number of additional ways that this is shaping the curriculum. One of these is that when we started this work, Professor Maggie Neal and I, again, both of us in the organizational behavior group, felt called to action to develop a course which we call Diverse by Design, which is an online class for our LEED certificate. And one of the things that we are trying to do is teach organizations to think about how they can design various kinds of interventions to ramp up a sense of belonging and inclusion, and also to increase diversity. So one of the things that's exciting about this online class is that the modules within it are available for use in the MBA classroom should a faculty member want to use it. Another thing that we've been working on is sourcing new underrepresented minority and women folks, business leaders, who could serve as both classroom speakers and also case protagonists. So we've put in place resources and a person to build a database of interesting people who could come to classes or serve as protagonists, and we're making that database available to all faculty so they can look through by, say, industry, if they're teaching something specific to an industry, and then find, for example, an African-American protagonist or speaker to come. And then a third, I think, is something that you already made reference to when you were chatting with Lori a minute ago, the case study audit. So you've already talked a little bit about that, and Lori mentioned that part of what's happened as an outgrowth of that is that faculty are made aware when they're using cases which contain stereotypical language. And I think as a bright light, several of our faculty who are using cases that they've written have come forward and asked us for help on revising sections of those case studies to remove some of these stereotypical representations. And then, Lori already mentioned the way in which the students have built on the women's circles to come up with their version of this, which they call pods, which they're prototyping this quarter. And so far what we're hearing is that the students are just delighted with this new program. And we love that this was completely student-led by our current MBA 2s. And so we look forward to hearing how this progresses into the next quarter. And then finally, I'll mention one more thing that we launched this term, which is that I've been running, along with some of our learning design specialists here, workshops on creating a classroom, a sense of classroom inclusion. And the reasoning, I think, for this was that first, we need to train our new faculty on how to both manage sensitive topics in the classroom, but also begin to teach about bias and how bias affects business leaders. Leaders, and not just the classroom here, but business leaders, because of course our alums will become leaders eventually. But then I think the other sort of goal of this now is that we are rolling these out, and we'll do another one in a couple of weeks, to all interested faculty, not just our brand new faculty, and also all of our lecturers as well, so not just our tenure line faculty. So in short, I think what's very exciting for us is that the work that we've been doing is really sort of leading to a groundswell of activity around the school, particularly around the MBA curriculum and how we teach here at the GSB.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds to me like you have been, at minimum, you've been successful at sort of bringing together what, I guess Lori had mentioned, there's kind of this constellation of activity, and now it has like sort of a focal point with the report, and it seems like it's having a lot of impact on the curriculum. And so that's terrific to hear. Lori, if I could turn back to you, what do you think this means to the average prospective student that's considering Stanford's MBA program? I mean, our listeners, as you know, are, you know, applying to the very best business schools, and they're always trying to understand what makes a school unique. Yeah, what does this mean for, what would you say to our listeners who are kind of considering Stanford and maybe have some questions about diversity and you know, equity and inclusion?
I'm actually really excited about what this means for our prospective students. One thing we know for certain is that the challenges they'll be addressing in businesses are growing more and more complex, and that they'll have to solve these problems with global diverse teams. And so the first way this work will impact them is giving them some tools to be more effective in leading those teams in the future. they'll also experience a very different campus than they might have when I went to business school so long ago. The campus is really looking at ways to be as welcoming and inclusive as possible. Graham, I don't know if you've heard of the idea of ambient belonging.
I've not, actually.
I hadn't either, but it's the idea that the cues you are given by the images on campus and what services are available can send signals about whether you'll survive here or thrive here or not. And so we've really taken seriously this idea of creating the campus to have images that reflect the current population. We've done things like making sure that there are lactation rooms, that there are all gender bathrooms, so that when students come on campus, they can truly feel like they belong. We've also included some of this curriculum as early as week zero when they come for their orientation, so that if they're not familiar with these ideas or they come from a place where they're not talked about broadly, that they'll all have some of the similar curriculum. And the students can also, if they are really interested, join a student group on this. There's a diversity and inclusion committee in our student government. And lastly, one of my big aims is to make sure that I go on what I'm calling a listening tour, that I speak to all of our communities, our student groups, our alumni groups, our staff groups, and find out from them what they really would like to see, almost like asking the question, if you could wave a magic wand and make something happen here at the GSB, what would you like? And then we're knitting together all those ideas to ensure that our plans reflect what our communities really want, to empower them as leaders of the future, but also to have a great experience while they're here at the GSB.
That makes sense. I mean, as part of my work, I've actually had the chance to be, I guess it's been somewhere between 40 and 50 universities that I've visited over the last 2 years. And I think
that's great.
It really varies, you know, in terms of what schools and institutions are doing in this domain. It varies from schools that seem to have not really, you know, taken note of like what's going on in the world, to schools that are, you know, incredibly progressive in this area. So I think it's great to hear that you're thinking about that campus experience and what people see, and it makes absolute sense. If I could put both of you on the spot, I did have a question, which is, you know, Stanford's business school is, you know, in the backyard of so many big tech companies, right? I mean, there's, you know, Google down the road, et cetera, right? So, and one of the things that we see in the popular press over and over again is this sort of stereotyping around, oh, big tech companies are these kind of engineery tech bro environments. And that, you know, just kind of read about this over and over again. And I think, Laura, you had mentioned that some of the work you're doing is actually taking you out into the business world, where you're working with companies. And so I just wondered if you might be willing to comment on that. I mean, I think some of this is probably, you know, there's a little media driven things happening, but I think there's probably some truth in the fact that, you know, some of these companies have for so many years been dominated by kind of white guy engineers, or at least just engineers and males, let's say. So what, like, have you had any direct exposure to these companies? I assume you have. And how's that piece of this going?
That's a great question. And as you know, we've really looked at the kinds of speakers we bring into the GSB and the opportunities our students go. So this isn't just an interest from us being in the backyard, but we really care about the kinds of companies that hire our students when they graduate here from GSB. And here's kind of a bright spot in what you're saying. This is a moment in time where there's a lot of pressure on organizations, pressure from social movements where shareholder activists really care about these issues, are putting pressure on leaders, as well as employees acting as movement builders trying to change from within. So the good news is that the external and internal pressures right now are causing organizations to take these issues seriously. And what I've discovered is that when we started doing this work 5 years ago in companies, we mostly spoke to women's summits, the women's groups who were trying to motivate change from within. Today, we're seeing more and more leaders come through our executive education, inviting us into the C-suite. So diversity, equity, and inclusion is no longer something managed by HR teams. It's really a leadership issue. CEOs need to decide whether they make a statement. Companies need to decide how they're going to address these issues. And so I think that's a great bright spot. So the combination of goodwill plus pressure really does I think, great to change. And I know my colleague Sarah probably has something really important to say about that as well.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Lori. I mean, well done, Lori. But I wanted to also just add, based on everything that Lori just said, it really behooves us and our peers to make sure that we are producing leaders that will lead organizations to become more diverse, to promote a sense of inclusion and equitable access. And I think our students know that. They are watching the same kind of press that you referred to, listening to the same things that you referred to, Graham, and they want to be better. They want to lead in a better way. And so there's a really nice opportunity that meshes well with the bright spots that Lori just discussed.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thanks for responding to, you know, something just sort of impromptu, but I was curious about that. The next question I had for Sarah is, you know, part of the report or this sort of I guess there's this piece called the Ideal Dashboard that was kind of the beginning stage where, or the kind of centerpiece almost, where you're tracking, kind of diversity on campus. And I think you mentioned that not only just faculty, but staff and students, obviously. And I looked at those numbers and it was really interesting to see the progress that the school is making in terms of, improving diversity within the campus community. With that said, I was curious to know if you have a sense of how the MBA program sort of measures up in some of those key diversity areas, whether it's women versus men or, diversity in terms of underrepresented minorities, et cetera. How does the school, like when it's compared to, say, peer programs, how do you feel that you're measuring up?
Yes, thanks. Yeah, thanks, Graham. So I think most of our peer schools release some information, at least on their websites. And of course, we took a look at these and continue to look at them. And, you know, one of the things I think is pretty interesting is if we look at the most recent figures that have been released, Stanford and Wharton are doing the best, at least in terms of women, of the peer schools. Note that there have been a couple of articles in Poets and Quants this year, one in January and one in September, that talk about some of our non-peer schools saying that they've hit 50%. So this is something that I think is terrific and something that we can aspire to, I hope, as well, both Stanford and Wharton, which seem to top the peer schools. In terms of U.S. minority status, it's a little bit more difficult because I think schools count these and track this differently. But you can see in the DEI report and also on the Ideal website, ours currently is at 27%. But as I said, that's a little more difficult because these are tracked differently. And then I think, you know, one of the ones that's very tricky is that LGBTQ status is not something that we ask. We have an active pride group on campus, and we have an executive program for LGBTQ leaders, which hopes to connect with our on-campus students. But it's hard because typically schools don't track that. Wharton actually is an exception here. And they ask a question and say, at least on their website, that 5% of their MBA population identifies as LGBTQ. And again, it's hard to know if that's accurate and how accurate it is, but something certainly to think about. I think importantly, though, what we see across all peers is that there's been movement in increasing diversity, and I think that that's really encouraging.
I totally agree. I also think that Stanford is in kind of a fortunate position. I mean, if you're an applicant to Stanford, you probably, you know, people know that the acceptance rate is incredibly low, which means that, you know, Kirsten Moss and the admissions team usually have their pick of of the litter when it comes to selecting and shaping a class. So I think Stanford's lucky in that respect. And I'm not surprised to hear that you're kind of leading the way or, you know, certainly on par with some of the other peer schools like Wharton. So obviously good to hear. I was also really interested to read that there was another school, and I think it was USC, that had said they'd hit the 50% mark last year. I think they fell short this year, but it is just nice to see that this is finally happening because it's, I mean, when I don't want to date myself, but when I did my MBA, it was like unheard of for a school to have more than 30% women. So things have really shifted, which is great. Another question for you is, and this is a little tricky, but I was curious to know, how might applicants to the GSB showcase their own diversity and just their interest and support for the mission of this DEI report? Any advice to candidates if they're, you know, wanting to kind of express the sort of, you know, that they really like this initiative and want to support it in some way?
Yes, sure. Well, you know, in general, our advice that we always give to applicants is that, you know, our students and our alum just don't even fit into a mold at all. And so we don't expect them to either. But of course, we look for authentic expressions of who they are, what their strengths are, what their beliefs are, and so on. And so authentically expressing the way in which they support this, of course, is something that I think is important, but also authentically expressing their past experiences around diversity, equity, and inclusion would certainly be welcome as well.
Yeah, I think one thing that's always fascinated me about the admissions process for Stanford's MBA program is that you have this main essay, which I'm presuming you guys might be familiar with, which is just what matters most to you and why. That's kind of the question. And I think for many MBA applicants, it's sort of this daunting thing. But I've always thought of it as such a great sort of philosophical approach to thinking about, like, you know, business school and the, you know, the candidate's background and future and plans and everything. And it's just a great exercise. In fact, I often tell candidates, even if they're not applying to Stanford, to think about that question before they start anything, you know, with respect to business school applications.
That's great advice.
Yeah. I mean, that essay leaves a lot of room for people to do the needed self-exploration. And it's great to hear you mentioning authenticity, because I think that's really, I used to work in admissions at Wharton. And, you know, we always, it's just, yeah, people telling stories about what they've done is always most valuable, rather than making claims about what they would do.
You know, Graham, I don't know if you know this, but we've added a new section to the application for comments. And if a prospective student wanted to, they could add some thoughts about how they've thought about diversity, equity, and inclusion there. And, you know, I've seen this more and more on applications. So faculty searches here on campus have included a question like that. I know at some PhD programs for faculty positions, they also have to address this. So it's becoming more common. So thinking about that might be something a prospective student could add to the comment section of our application.
Great. That makes sense. And I would just encourage all of our listeners, if you're curious, to just head over to Stanford's website or just Google Stanford DEI report. You'll find the website immediately. And the reports, not that this matters, but it's beautifully laid out and really easy to navigate. And you can get all kinds of great information about, you know, anything from the statistics of all the different graduate programs in the university at large in terms of, representation for, and diversity and things. So, and all these initiatives that we've discussed in the podcast. So Sarah and Lori, I really want to thank you both for taking the time. I know that you have crazy schedules. Appreciate you making time to talk about this really exciting activity on campus. And hopefully you'll keep us posted as this progresses with time.
Yes. Wonderful, Graham. It was really terrific to talk with you. And we look forward to chatting again.
Yeah, and I would encourage our listeners to visit Stanford. I had the opportunity to get out to campus and visit the facilities, which are relatively new still. And, you know, from what Lori was describing about the steps you're taking to just make sure that it's a really welcoming environment, no reason not to go if you can get out there. So encourage everyone to listen. Thanks again, Lori and Sarah, for taking part. And listeners, stay tuned for more episodes of the Clear Admit MBA Admissions podcast. And always remember to rate and review this podcast in iTunes or on Spotify, if that's where you're listening these days. Thanks again, and we'll be back really soon.